Hello, and welcome to another episode of your favorite D&D podcast, Mastering Dungeons. I'm Sean Merwin, here with the ever-stylish, world-traveling, convention-organizing Teos Abadia. Teos, welcome back.
Thank you, Sean. It is really nice to be here. I super enjoyed hearing Dan and Jason on the show. That was awesome. And also the really nice feedback from all the folks who liked our previous world building episode. That's been really cool to see. Like, a lot of people were like, that's been my favorite episode so far, which is really cool. Cause you were kind of like, I don't know if this is going to be good or not. And yeah, it was great.
Hey, we'll take it. We'll switch back and forth. We'll do some reviews, some world building. So tell me about the glasses you were just wearing there, sir.
So I was very lucky. Thank you, Wizards. They sent a package out to some folks, and I've somehow managed to be on this list. And I mean, just as a collector alone, I love it. I really appreciate it. And hopefully it means that they kind of recognize some of the work that I put in, such as this weekend at Emerald City Comic Con, seating thousands of players nearly, many hundreds. They sent those glasses. They sent an ice bucket, which is superb. That's the best thing in there because it's this gold 50th anniversary logo ice bucket, which is great because I actually needed one for my gaming room that I'm setting up. Two very pretty glasses with etched design, gold trim, two gold colored wine stoppers. The idea is celebrate the 50th year anniversary. And if you know anything about marriages, 50th year anniversary is typically gold. So This is the golden anniversary. And so it was all kind of gold themed. There were two really cool coasters. So really nice. I mean, I loved it. There's always the thing where people could just go like, well, how about if I just got some cool books or some, you know, gold foil edition book or something. But I thought this was a fun idea and I appreciate them doing it. And I know it's part of PR and stuff, but still, I was very happy they chose me. And as luck would have it, the ice bucket is just perfect for me.
Hey, maybe they made it knowing exactly what you needed.
That would be no.
Speaking of exactly what you needed, you've been on a trip. You are now home and rested. How was Emerald City Comic Con?
It was amazing. I didn't know what to expect compared to PAX West. It's in the exact same building in Seattle, run by the same Reed Pop organizers for the various entities, PAX or Emerald City Comic Con. I heard a lot of things going in. One of them that I heard from a lot of the DMs that we had there at the show was, oh, this is a con where a lot of people come to play D&D. Like, they know, like, yeah, I'm a D&D player, I'm coming in. That was the furthest thing from what I saw when I was there. It was more than half of the people were learn to play, super casual. And again, kind of like PAX last year, you could not identify who a D&D player would be or who would be interested in D&D by looking at them. Pick a random character in a movie from a scene, and you might go like, that's not a D&D player. But I would say to everybody, want to play a 30-minute game of D&D? And that person, whatever you're imagining as not a D&D player, would say, oh, I run a campaign at home, but let me see if I can get some of my friends that haven't tried it, and I'll, you know, we'll join for a table. Like, you couldn't peg who was a D&D player or not, or who would be curious in D&D, but tons of people were into it, and we gave lots of people their first game. It was unbelievable, and I want to see more efforts like this, because I think there are too many conventions where we treat it as, oh, yeah, it's just the same gang coming in. And I think there are all kinds of, you know, clearly there are tons of players dying to try this game. A lot of it, this we heard Baldur's Gate mentioned, right, the video game. But, you know, we know there's still that residual, whether it's actual play, whether it's Stranger Things, whether it's just, but everybody knew, here's the thing, everybody knew D&D, right? Nobody was like, what's that?
Yeah. Right.
Now, of course, we are in geek circles and everything, but still, like, you know, whether they were there for, you know, any kind of TV property that they're into or comics or whatever, they understood what D&D was, but they might not know anything about the game. And one funny anecdotal thing, it's just one person, but there was a player who did the learn to play twice. And so coming out, I said, how do you feel about the game? And they said, you know, I think if I play it one more time, I'll get it. Mm-hmm. It just shows you the importance of learn to play and how even that can be, you know, you want to see it a couple times with a couple different DMs, right? It's really, I thought that was fascinating. So they did, they played it three times through the 30-minute learn to play to feel comfortable. Or another person that was really anxious about everything, they played with one DM, loved that DM. They were like, what else is this DM running? And then they played two other adventures, a 2-hour and a 4-hour as a brand new player, because they felt so comfortable with that one DM who put them at ease, right? So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, all those points, we could do a whole show on all those points you just made, right? How important it is to mix a learn to play thing that makes people learn, that helps people learn. Because I will go on to Reddit or whatever and read, what I'm a new DM running for new players, what should I run? And the things that some people come out with, right? Oh, Out of the Abyss is what you should run as a new DM with new players. I'm like, no.
And with all those NPCs at the beginning.
Exactly.
I mean, so, Sean, we've got a question that maybe we should just segue right into. It's our second question thing came in just via Gene Lorber on Blue Sky. And maybe we hit that question right now.
Okay. All right, let's do it. So here we go with Gene Lorber via Blue Sky. How well does the standard published by the Adventure format function as a user manual for the DM? What features could be added and subtracted to make them better?
So how about not 40 NPCs at the beginning of the Adventure?
Yeah. I think they, well, I don't know if there is a standard 5e published Adventure format that is consistent. It's going to depend on, you know, this is a different question than a new DM.
Sure. Sure.
So for just a DM.
Yeah. Yeah. A user's manual for a DM. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the current format serves a purpose fairly well, in the sense that what I want to see is, what is this adventure level wise? Who is it written for? How many characters of what level? And what are the themes, tones? Is it meant to be a horror? Is it meant to be a comedic adventure? Then I want the adventure background, an adventure summary in two paragraphs, what happens. And I think from that, depending on the game master, you may get a different thing that's needed. Some people need to know all the NPCs up front with a pronunciation guide for them to feel comfortable. I could care less, because I'm going to say it the way I want to say it. Right. And I'm not going to remember all of these NPCs in a list. I need to see them in action. So that's useless for me, but super important for someone else. So at this point, I think we're swapping out one person's strength for another person's weakness in terms of the things that are put in the adventure. What do you think?
You know, well, a couple of things. One is, you know, we reviewed a series of episodes where we talked about what are the intros to all of the 5e adventures, right? How do all of these start?
Right.
And we talked about sort of whether they are, you know, direct or clunky or overdone. And some of them had, you know, amazing amounts of backstory. And you're like, is this really necessary? Baldur's Gate, for example, you know, has a lot of earnest. And so I think that, you know, there are some things that could be better, like for sure could be done to, like you talked about, streamline that information up front so that you can get some decent amount, but it doesn't overwhelm you. I think the beginning of whether that beginning is so important, because you are probably, even if you've DM'd a fair amount, you're probably still trying to build up steam for your game. Scheduling is hard, right? Like, it's like everybody talks, that's like the number one enemy of the DM is scheduling. And if you start on a so-so session, that hurts, right? And so being able to have that first beginning be decent, like, I think one of the reasons the starter set is very popular, the first one, Phandelver, is because it's a decent start, right? Goblin ambush, goblin cave, like, you can roll with that. Almost anybody can run that and feel pretty good about it. And the players will feel pretty good about the experience. But something like Out of the Abyss is going to be highly variable with how you handle those NPCs. It's going to require a ton of work on your end. It's probably going to scare you. Icewind Dale, you know, which lead do you choose, and how does this tie into it? The separation between large story and micro story, you know, those kinds of things. And so I think that as user manuals, one of the first things we could do is a better start, better setup, better start, actual flow charts. And then it would be advice. You know, we seldom talk to the DM. D&D seems to have a sort of aversion from the DMG to the adventures of giving advice and speaking to the dungeon master about the reality of the game they're running. And that's what I'd like to see more of. DM David did a good article on what adventures in the past have given this kind of advice. And they're all really good. Like they really, his list is full of adventures that when I read them back in the day or recently, they made an impression on me and helped me moderate my game. And I think there could be more of that.
Yep. I agree. And the connections to something happening early in the adventure to later in the adventure need to be spelled out for a game master who can't prep a whole adventure ahead of time.
Yeah.
So if this, you know, if at level 4, they fight this monster or NPC, and what happens there will affect what happens in a battle or in several encounters at level 8. You need to tell the game master why it's important, what to keep track of. Is it a narrative or is it a user manual? Mm-hmm. Because if we want to make it completely narrative, we can go one way. If we want to make it a user manual, we would need to redesign adventures from the ground up.
Yeah.
What if you're a game master who wants to run one encounter at a time and you don't want to read ahead? You're going to one way. If you're a game master who wants to mine this adventure for other things, you don't want it to be that. You want it to be something completely different. So,
I
mean,
well, I'll argue a bit with that, Sean, in that I think that even then, understanding the purpose of something always helps you get a grasp of it, even if you're going to rob it for parts, right? And so I think that it is important. I think any author should look at, and no exception for D&D official stuff, you should look at where do I need to clue in the DM as to what the point of this is, right? If it's a dungeon with 40 rooms, probably not every single room, but maybe the section, the floor, the level, the area, you want to explain kind of what's going on here, right? It's Temple of Animal Evil. This is the floor where all the fire cultists are, but there are numerous opportunities to show incursions from this and that other cult and for the players to turn the tide against them through means other than battle, right? Something like that, that sets it up. So you go, oh yeah, that's what's kind of, I should be on my toes for that. Mm-hmm. Right. And then a particular encounter, something, some advice like, you know, the challenge isn't in the monsters, it's in the traps. Mm-hmm. Or the fun of the encounter is in the traps. Make sure to bring them into that, right? Or start the encounter when they're inside the room, because that's the way this will work. Just advice like that. Mm-hmm. That's the user manual part of it, and often critical to that experience, I think.
What I'm thinking of is like Peril in Pinebrook, where I went full user manual.
Yeah.
And many game masters, experienced game masters, would take a look at that if it was in a regular adventure. Even if I cut back 50% to get rid of the very, very basic nitty-gritty rules, game master would be like, I already know this. Let me skip to the story because I want to mine that. Or let me skip to the encounter because I want to mine that. And I mean, it would still work, but it just wouldn't be the same experience that one game master would want as opposed to another.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Shadow Dark sort of does that in a lot of the OSR adventures where they have this format of just sort of bolding certain keywords. And the theoretical idea doesn't really work with my brain particularly well is that you're just going to glance at these things and then you just kind of riff off of them. Mm-hmm. I am definitely of the mindset that I would rather have it be the other way, where you tell me kind of what is the point of this encounter? Why am I doing this? And give me a little more words and feeling. And then I may change that, but I want to properly understand what's there. And I want there to be something there. I want there in general, I want an encounter to have a reason it's fun. Not just, you know, two interesting features and a monster, go, right? Like, yeah. Orc and pie.
Yes. Well, that's a great question, Gene, to be dropped on us at the last minute, but thank you for sending that in. We have another question from Dave C via YouTube. As a fan of Dark Souls, the video game, I recognize tracking stamina and exhaustion can be a very fun element of some game experience. That requires really integrating it with the other game systems, though. Beyond the unilateral exhaustion makes everything harder. Kind of like they tried to do with the inspiration system. Make it a currency that enables players to make meaningful decisions about spending it and suffer the drawbacks. Give more ways to help recover from it, more systemized ways of gaining exhaustion, etc. That can all be fun. It's just a lot more work. And we had this discussion with Dan and Jason about exhaustion, and we had a nice there was a on YouTube there's a little thread, a discussion thread about this, culminating with Dave's question here. And this is interesting. When I see this and my game design brain kicks in, what I do is remove the words and just put in like X or Y, and then try to look at this mathematically or mechanically. So when I see when so I remove stamina slash exhaustion, I recognize that tracking X can be a very fun element of some game experience, because what you call it doesn't matter. It's just a system that needs to work narratively, right, thematically, and mechanically, fun, flavorful, and effing balanced, all coming together. And so when you look at it that way, exhaustion is supposed to be thematically a penalty. So if you are just making it yet another system that players can game, you are turning it from what it's meant to be thematically to just another mechanic that min-maxers will use to their benefit while minimizing the penalties.
Ah, that's really interesting.
Unless you perfectly balance it, which is, another 6 months of play testing with all the other things that it needs to balance with. So it's tough. Dave is right that it can be fun, but it's not even as easy as Dave makes it out.
I mean, it's interesting that you made me think a lot through what you were saying there. Because if I pull back, what's the point a lot of times for me in exhaustion? It's capturing sort of environmental things like extreme cold or heat or representing how grueling the trek is. And sometimes it's just like a thing a monster does to you or a trap or something, and that's okay. But there are a lot of ways we can capture that. But that whole, how best do you capture the idea that this trip might be exhausting? Fourth edition did it by removing healing surges, right? Which was a perfectly functional way to do it because you did have a use for those. They didn't always matter, but in some adventures they really did. And it was a way that a DM could actually do things so that it all, dovetailed together and worked and mattered. And so maybe just all of the exhaustion system is a bad idea, and it's less about whether it's minus one per track or it's certain things at certain tracks. Maybe it's just that this doesn't really work very well with what fifth edition is trying to do, kind of at all, right? Because it's the problem, and 5e gets into this with curses and things like that too, right? If the cleric can just wave it away, well, what was the point of it? But then if you don't have a cleric, are you absolutely, out of it? It So maybe we're just dealing with the wrong thing. Like, what if exhaustion was more like you have the exhausted condition and a DM could decide that a skill is at disadvantage because of your exhaustion? It often won't be for normal checks, but it would be if you were doing something where that plays into, you're trying to climb a wall or you're trying to continue your exploration, then that maybe is hindered. And maybe it would do things like limit what you get back from a rest. Right, maybe enough hit dice mean you need to spend a whole day just getting out of the exhausted state, or I don't know. There are lots of ways one can do it. I tend to think that exhaustion, while the minus one, minus two playtest version we saw is better, they probably took it away because it's not quite perfect. And the question is, will they put something else in there? And they might not because time, but I think maybe the answer is somewhere different. Like, you know, you pull back and go back to the beginning of what you're trying to do and design something for that.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that you might see a game system try is to give you a status like exhausted, but then give you something that you gain when you are exhausted. So the ranger has an ability. When you are exhausted, you can also do this to sort of offset, as Dave is saying here, the penalty that it might give you. Okay, you're at -1 on all your checks. However, you gain this ability, which works in theory until you unbalance something somehow so that now the ranger actually wants a level of exhaustion because they need this power to work. So they're outside running in circles while everyone else is camping because they want to be exhausted, right? So that's the sort of thing you, yeah. It's like, oh, this will be so great if we do this. One place that we've talked about and we've seen it work well as intended is the Alien RPG mm-hmm. with the stress dice. Right.
Yeah.
It's a bad thing, but it can be a good thing, but it's most likely a bad thing.
Yeah. And to review, you get more dice, which means more chances at success. But these dice you're getting have a face hugger symbol on them. And if you roll that, you start doing bad things, just like people in the movies start losing it. You will start losing it when you get those things. And so it becomes both an awesome thing, more chances at success, and a terrible thing, peril might happen. And that's great.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. But so it works because of the particular mechanic of rolling lots of D6s. And so it all fits into it. You can't just be like, hey, roll this D20 with a face hugger on it for exhaustion, right? It's not as simple as that. But maybe you could, right? Maybe you could create a table that you, when you do a check and it would play off of exhaustion according to the DM, maybe you roll on the table to see whether something happens. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
It's complicated.
It is. It's a great game design quandary that Dave brings up here.
It should be on the D&D hiring list, right? You know, design me a fix to exhaustion. Yeah.
Exactly. Final question, because it relates to Shadowdark, which we will be talking about in our main segment today. Kurt Ugel, 4576 via YouTube. In Shadowdark's excellent game mastery section, which we will be covering, I loved the pact, the whole core ethos section, and modes of play. Regarding the latter, I remember during D&D Next hoping that the DMG would have a lot of advice on modes of play, but we didn't quite get what I'd hoped. Do you have recommendations for a resource that discusses different modes of play? Do you have favorites? Chapter 9 of the current 5th edition DMG does sort of talk about that. There are ways to do different kinds of rests. Discussed. You know, there are ways to do horror and ways to do madness and that sort of thing. So it's sort of there, but it doesn't quite break it down in a way that clicks as, okay, this is a mode of play. I know that the Grim Hollow campaign guide does some mode of play stuff similar to what the DMG did, you know, in terms of dealing with curses differently, in terms of different rest mechanics. I know that I've seen over the years many game master advice blogs, streams, podcasts where they do talk about these things and give some advice on how to change modes of play, but they're so widespread that I can't pinpoint one to say, check that one out.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, a game that does it really well is Knights Black Agents, right? So in Knights Black Agents, the entire book has little bits where it will put in a sort of, if you're running this mode or that mode, and I think it has kind of three modes, if I recall correctly. One of them is where, like, you have no agency support, so you've been burned and outed. And then I forget what the other one is, but there's another mode. But what it means is throughout the entire book, they have to cover these things. And while it's really cool, it's a lot of work. And if you imagine a game like D&D with all those supplements and all those adventures, well, do you really support them all? Or do you just leave that in the DMG and then abandon it, which is kind of what we see with Chapter 9's work? It's hard. And a lot of the answer to these kinds of modes of play is subsystems.
Yep.
And maybe D&D is smart in leaving it to other companies, where we see like what Grim Hollow does, or we see like, you know, the Cubicle 7 stuff with overland travel being a much more expanded thing, or systems like downtime that you can choose to lean into or not. Because it's hard to really do something like say, hey, you have hit dice, or hey, spells are not Vancian, right? Like it's not easy to do that, and especially not to support it beyond that. And I think that's what happened with 5e, with D&D Next, is when they were doing that playtest and talking about this being a great idea, it was a great idea. And once they tried to do anything around a deadline, they go, oh, yeah, no, we're not doing that.
There was a lot of talk, not from Wizards, but from fans saying, oh, they're going to make these modules that you can plug in or take out. Oh, I want to run a OSR style 5e game. I'll plug this in or pull the, and I knew that this was never going to happen for the reasons we talked about. And one of the issues with these modes of play is it's fine to say, all right, DM, change the way rest rules work to make this a grittier game. But there has to be something on the player side too. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's just superheroes in a gritty game.
Yeah. Yeah. Like to me, a great example is if you look at, there have been a couple of really neat, and this comes from thinking about Jared Rasher's recent excellent blogging. There have been a number of cases where D&D explored the character path concept, the life path, life history background. The Exandria book, I think it's the Exandria Wildmount, one of them looks at that. And there is Xanathar's has a section on it. And then you have the Cubicle 7 book, which is what Jared was reviewing. But if you look at those earlier efforts that D&D has done officially, they're neat. They give you good ideas for your backstory. But there's that second part of it, which is then tying it into the adventure and into your actual play. Like, yeah, you know, your home was ravaged by ogres or whatever it is, and you have this goal of X, Y, and Z. Great. Now the DM has to weave that in, and there's nothing doing that for you, which is fine. Many DMs can roll with it, but the ideal part would be that next part that links it into the actual product. And that's the part that it's just too hard to keep trying to do that for every optional system you have. So it just falls on the DM to make it work. And that's, you know, I think that's ultimately what gets to, I think, Kurt's question is, you know, how modes of play really work. Well, the best modes of play are propped up by the rest of what you use. And we'll, maybe we talk a little bit about that in Shadow Dark with some of the suggestions they have, because I think it's somewhat similar. These are fun ideas, and you may use them as a sort of source of house rules, but they're ultimately not really supported by the rest of it, you know, unless you do that work.
For sure. So thank you for those great questions. Now let's get into our news and commentary section, starting with the Adventurers League moving into D&D Beyond. Oh, Teos, we could go on and on about this in our vast experience with organized play, from the RPGA to Living Greyhawk to Living Forgotten Realms to everything.
How do you put everything in one place so everybody can get to it and know about your program?
Yep. So we've gotten there. Teos has in our show notes this nice thing, Once Upon a Time in a Galaxy Far, Far Away. There was a website for the Adventurers League Organized Play Program, and then it moved to the D&D website at Wizards, and then it didn't get updated because people in the Adventurers League couldn't get a hold of the people that ran that site. So then they went to the Yawning Portal, which became even harder to find. And then it went to the D&D Beyond Discord, which was easier to find for some, but much harder to find for other folks. And now it's moving to D&D Beyond. There was a blog describing what the Adventurers League is, how to participate, and a link to the resources that are current for the Adventurers League. More articles are said to be coming, and we will hear about the future of this program, how to find this and other articles, news, etc., etc. What was your reaction when you saw this?
So I'm very glad that there's something other than Discord, because you tell a lot of people to join Discord and they go, yeah, no, right? Or I can't keep up with it or any of it. And even though they try, like you can follow their news channel and stuff, there are still tons of people who can't find what they want. And there's a disconnect between an announcement on Discord and a file that lives there temporarily, and then that file actually ever being anywhere else that you can find it. So treating a website as the actual default, I think, would be great. The trouble is the blog disappears, right? Like, try to find the errata on Spelljammer. You got to go searching in the D&D Beyond blog area. And especially for somebody casual, good luck with that. So it ultimately needs to be pinned somewhere, as it was on the old D&D website. We need something on the D&D Beyond site that people know to go to and that it stands out, right? If you're brand new, you were just at a convention or you saw a play somewhere and you want to find resources, oh, look, this is pretty clear to me and I can find everything. So I think that's the intent. Hopefully it does take place.
Yep.
And is kept up to date.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see that with this move, if there are plans now for more Adventures League content, which is a whole different topic. But we know we will be getting some new Adventures League content because a group from the Philippines called the Greasy Snitches has become the first international premier organizer for the Adventures League, which means they can create adventures for Adventures League play as Bald Man Games and Game Hole Con and Game Hole Publishing do right now. And the Adventures League is also inviting other international groups who are interested in becoming a premier organizer by reaching out to the admins on the D&D Discord.
Yes, that was the most hilarious part of this webpage is, you know, we're moving all our information here. By the way, if you were interested in becoming a premier organizer in some other country, hey, you know, go to the channel on the D&D Discord where the admins hang out. Mm-hmm. Okay. And, you know, so first I want to say, like, this is great, right? Because recognizing other countries and the strong work they often do to organize is awesome. This is not the first time we've done that, right? We've had Living Greyhawk had regions such as Italy and the UK. 4E had regions in Brazil, recognizing the strong D&D play that was happening in Brazil. These haven't always been successes over time. It is hard, especially because often nobody is really truly administering and constantly reaching out because those people are too busy to do so. But I want to make it clear that I'm excited that this is happening. I like it that we're organized, we're reaching out to other groups, we're trying to empower other groups in other countries. At the same time, AL is in a weird place where it has thousands of adventures and it's unclear that it needs more. You know, if we're going to create a bunch of other groups doing what Baldwin Games and Gamehole Con do, I worry that's going to further devalue new adventures, make it so that people who write them aren't really getting paid much at all because they're not going to get many sales in the DMs Guild and so on and so forth. And it just creates a lot of glut of content. So I worry where this will lead while also wanting to see this recognition. I don't know that the recognition should come hand in hand with writing adventures as much as being receiving support for the activities they're doing to bring in new players is where I would, but I'm not knowledgeable on this. You know, I don't see it on the ground level. What do I know?
Yeah. Well, I think the Philippine group was big with creating these experiences, just like Bald Man Games creates experiences through convention play and Game Hole Con through its convention. So I think it was a reward for that work. And when you do that work, one of the perks is creating content. But as you say, if you're throwing, you know, a small pebble into the ocean of content, it may be great for you as that individual convention organizer, experience organizer, but it's not necessarily making any waves in the larger pool of not just Adventures League players, but D&D players.
And is it a perk in that sometimes it can be a trap, right? If I say to you, hey, congratulations, Sean, because you've worked so hard, you get to administer a whole region and come up with a whole storyline and organize authors and edit adventures and write them all and find art for them and lay out and then publish them in the DM's Guild and earn nothing. Mm-hmm. Have I given you a reward or have I trapped you?
Well, it can be a trap if you don't know what you're getting into.
I didn't know what I was getting into.
But it can be helpful if you understand your limits.
Yeah.
And you use the credit card that you're given in terms of being able to create this content legally, this content. You can use it just for the means to the end that you're trying to get to. I want to bring new players to my show.
Yeah.
So we're going to offer this.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right.
It's possible.
It is. Yeah. It is. It's marketing.
Yeah.
It's marketing for Wizards.
Yeah.
And the Adventures League that you are getting allowed to do, and there's not necessarily a great deal of revenue that will be created by this,
right?
At least in terms of sales of adventures.
Yeah.
Can you create experiences that will draw people in and maybe make you more money? There's the question. Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
But still, I want to make it clear. I'm glad for the group in the Philippines, and I would be glad for others to also receive that kind of elevation while raising these cautions.
For sure. You read a book called The Fallbacks, Bound for Ruin. We had mentioned this earlier. There's the book. We had mentioned this. D&D and Random House were releasing a new D&D novel. You can now get it in bookstores, and Teos received an advanced copy. So tell us about it, Teos.
It's good. You know, it's for folks interesting, you know, curious about how dense it is. That gives you a feel for it if you're watching the video. It was a really fun read, honestly. I had hopes for it in that when I think about the D&D novels that I've enjoyed, they are things like one of the first ones I read was Spellfire by Ed Greenwood. And what I loved about that was not the big names and the big lore. Those things I actually found a little clunky to me. It was the stories about making a campfire and traversing the wilderness and being scared of it, or being thrown through a portal into a dungeon and having to deal with that. Like, that was the kind of stuff that I was like, yes, I deal with this. You know, my character deals with this. And that gave me ideas. This book is full of that kind of thing, like cool ideas of the types of things that you deal with as both a GM and a player. Mm-hmm. It is not so simplistic that it's for only young audiences, but straddles, I think, really well. Both, you could be young and enjoy this. It doesn't have, you know, exceeding violence or sex or drugs or anything like that. So it's totally the kind of thing that as a parent you'd like to give your kid. But it is an entertaining story with meaningful stories and challenges that the individual characters are trying to get over it, overcome. And the characters are all super interesting. It's a very diverse party, and a large theme of the book is sort of how can they come together to be a good group, right? And so we have like a bard tiefling, we have a half-elf warrior, half-elf, that leads the group, wizard, cleric, and an audio companion. And they can have some really neat things, like the cleric, for example, and this is not a big spoiler, you see this right kind of from the beginning, is that the cleric doesn't just pray for spells, they bargain for them. And so they're reaching out to different deities every time to negotiate the casting of that spell.
That's funny.
Right. A lot of the characters have this kind of something, like a little hook like that, right? That's like an example of, hey, this is a great character concept that you could come up with just by reskinning and role playing. And so it's full of these kinds of ideas. So I think as a player, it'll give you great ideas on how you could bring a character to life, and how the backstory can play out over time. It's a very D&D tale. It's full of spells you'll recognize, monsters you'll recognize, locations like Undermountain, groups like the Zhentarim, threats like liches, you know, rust monsters, you name it. And it it has neat ideas on things like treasure. So and little things like how the party splits up treasure and what they do with it and how it matters to them. And one of my favorites is there's a really cool example for treasure that they get that over time sort of unlocks and becomes more. Doesn't quite use the rules for Acquisitions Incorporated's franchise rules, but it could be inspired by them, or at least has some parallel concepts of how their kind of home base, which is also a magic item, evolves over time. And boy, if you're a DM, steal that idea, right? Take the franchise rules, take this concept of what's this magic item in here, that I'm going to avoid spoiling more than this, and play with that, because you could really just, I mean, that could be the centerpiece of a kind of the background of a really cool campaign. So I'd highly recommend it. There's a link to Powell's, but you can find that everywhere. It's out now. We got an advanced copy. Thank you to Random House for that. Excellent novel. It clearly indicates that there could be a sequel, so I hope there is.
Nice. From the depths of fantasy to the heights of space, NASA has released a role-playing game, and you can write indie adventures using NASA material. So the space agency NASA released an RPG game called The Lost Universe. It is a free 44-page PDF that has a resemblance to D&D, but is not actually D&D. And the game is meant to teach science concepts during play. You can get this at science.nasa.gov. And look at Mission, Hubble, Multimedia, Online Activities, The Lost Universe. And from Itch, we also have an Indie NASA TTRPG Adventures Bundle. If you have any adventure for a role-playing game that centers on at least one image from NASA, you can submit it to the bundle, and you have until June 5th of this year to do that.
Pretty cool.
Yep. And more cool news coming from Kobold Press and Steamforged Games. Steamforged has a number of boxed products like the Epic Encounters boxes with minis, maps, and an adventure. Kobold Press has its new Tales of the Valiant game. And the two are going to join forces to create a starter set, box set, for this new Tales of the Valiant system. Interesting thoughts, interesting concepts. Yeah. Two companies that are seemingly competitors coming together to make a product.
Yeah, I dig that. I mean, you don't often see this in our industry, and I feel like we should see it more, because this is a smart recognition of, hey, you know, this company creates these box sets, has distribution deals all over the place. You know, I see them in my gaming store. I see them in other gaming stores. I see them at conventions. So if you have that network and that capability, that lets us do something that otherwise would be hard for us, right? To go and contract some individual company in China and work this all out. Nope, you make it, right? I think that's really neat. And I hope we see kind of more like that from Steamforged Games or other companies. It's a smart move to me. That's cool.
We now have the SRD in Braille, thanks to Wormworks Publishing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so Wormworks Publishing, you know, we know Dale who works there. They have focused on games that further inclusivity and accessibility, really in almost everything they do. Really impressive, and it's worth checking out their main website, just learning about that. But their latest endeavor is a free Braille version of the SRD. You can download the BRF and the BBZ formats of the SRD. It includes the Player's Guide, Game Master's Guide, Monster Manual, and Spellcasting Guide content. It is all open access, so it's released under a CC BY license for anyone to freely use and adapt. And there's a tutorial included which equips publishers and homebrew creators with the tools to convert their own content into Braille using free software. So would you like to create a free Braille version of what you have already created? Here's how. And the tutorial video on YouTube, you can find that all from the link below at Wyrmworks, W-Y-R-M, workspublishing.com. Direct link is in our show notes. I can also say that Wyrmworks has converted the Forge of Foes SRD and the Lazy DM SRD from Sly Flourish Mike Shea, to Braille. So stay tuned for that, and we'll have links for the Forge of Foes in Braille, which is really cool.
Awesome. And last but not least, I want to thank everybody who has backed Surviving Strange Hollow. It went to Kickstarter Tuesday last week. We just topped 70,000, so thank you so much. You still have a few more weeks to back it. You can go to get.accidentalcyclops.com, which will redirect you to the Kickstarter. So thanks for your support. And if you're interested in new art, new rules for a strange, fanciful, deadly, cute, but weird and menacing world, head on over there. Now for our main topic this week, we are going to finish our look at the Shadow Dark role-playing game. We've gone taken a few episodes to go through the player-facing content and the basic rules of the game. So now we're going to look at the section meant for game masters. So we start out with a section that I really love. The prose of it, the tone of it, it's almost poetic in places. Yeah. Every once in a while, I'll go, yes, yes, yes. And then I'll go, no. But then I'll go, yes, yes, yes. Because it's a lot of like short, terse advice that rings true. But sometimes it's more of a truism than a truth. But that's okay. Because I love the tone of it. What are some of the things, Teos, that you read in this section that sort of stands out?
Yeah, there's some great quotes like, you want only one thing, to see your players triumph. And then I think to myself, why are we murdering them? The only rule is that you make the rules. What is written in this book is a guide, not a constraint, and none of it takes precedence over your judgment. And then the pact. You and your players are gaming together to have fun, prop each other up, and strengthen bonds, right? And so it is good. I think a lot of it, you know, is trying to speak to things that the industry has done poorly over time, especially in the older editions of D&D. So it is important to really spend some time on this, talking about your role and the players themselves. So overall, it's good. At times, I think to myself, well, boy, I'd like a little more explanation behind this statement to make it align with your actual gameplay versus just being a recommendation for how to approach games in general.
Yeah, it's a shorthand for people that have already read the book.
Yeah.
Not this book, but all the other books.
Yeah, all the books.
Right. It's here are some things that we've become aware of over the 50 years of role-playing games that we've made and played and loved. And there's always an argument about the game master's always right versus right, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
The game master can do anything they want. And so this book is using just quick, short bursts of information to show where it stands on that question. And sometimes it's contradictory,
yeah.
Right? The only rule is that you make the rules. Does that negate the other, you know, 330 pages of the book? Mm-hmm. Because if the only rule is you make the rules, then that's all you need is just you make the rules. Now, obviously, right. What yeah. that means is use the rules in a way that is pleasing to you, your players, and the experience.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I mean, you know, and I can, blip,
I get the point.
I can cite numerous Jeremy Crawford interviews where he has tried to say for 5e, hey, you know, it's up to you, the DM, to which most fans say, yes, but write the rules well, you know, and mm-hmm. and so, you know, there's always that give and take of like, it is good advice, right? Fundamentally, it is good advice. The whole ruling's not rules and you get to, mm-hmm. you're the final say and run the game you want it. Totally true. Does not remove the necessity of the rules making sense, being consistent, pointing to each other, all that other thing. But yes, it, sure. Like it's valuable to state it here. And there's some parts here, like on the players page, it says, it tries to speak to kind of how to make them be motivated. And so it says, like, adventure hooks. You're encouraging the players to grab onto those threads and make the call to adventure more enticing by knowing what your players want. And that works well at a surface level. But if I try to think, well, great, give me an example of this, right? Then I don't know what that is. Like, I don't necessarily know what the next step, what is an adventure hook? What does it look like in Shadow Dark? In a game where I'm kind of exploring around in caverns and dungeons, what should that particularly be for this game? And I don't get that here. Now, of course, I can make that up. I can figure it out. I can look at published adventures. But again, this is a place where there could be more. And the game is being very brief, right?
Yeah. And it's the same thing I said before, right? This book is not for new DMs. This is not a book for new. And I've, at first I was like, but, and now I've given up on the but. And just, I'm like, okay, this book is a one part of an ongoing 50-year conversation. So it is giving good advice for people who know the advice, but need to be reminded of the advice. Yeah. Yeah. So yes, give them good adventure hooks. It is great advice. How do you do it? Go to all the other books you've ever read to figure that out. Mm-hmm. Give them treasure and XP. Yeah. So some games don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And or have gotten away from that. So
And what I might have said here is or wanted to see here is, in a game that's specifically often about dungeon exploration or underground exploration, have periodic arcs of story and goals that have various, you know, completion times, so that it isn't just roam around, stab stuff, solve stuff, but rather that there's a story element to it. Yeah. And I think that's a very important thing to say in a game that could be mistaken for being just about sort of loot things, take treasure, right? Like take treasure, kill stuff. And that maybe that's what I would have liked to have seen here, is a little more of speaking to that. Hey, this isn't a game that's just that, right? Mm-hmm. Because then the game falls apart.
Make them light a torch.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, and things like that, I mean, are important. Like, there's a piece here on dramatic questions. Most encounters have a simple yes, no question driving the interest. When that question is answered, it's no longer exciting. Move forward. The question isn't whether a troll guarding a bridge can be killed by the characters, but whether the characters can get across. And so that's very few words trying to carry a lot, right? But that idea that the game is more than just slaying, the game should have the hooks, the questions, the encounters should have some complexity and flexibility to them, right? That there's a lot there this is trying to say efficiently, which is very admirable, but hard to do.
Yeah, and I will say what I just said before, right? This is the perfect example of, I'm going to choose a game at random, Dungeon World or Powered by the Apocalypse or Fate, right? Those are games that in some cases come right out and say, you are playing to answer a question. Once the question has been answered, move on. Rather than fighting out this fight to the death or you know, what have you. And so this is just drawing from that well, that spring of story game hardware, technology, and bringing it in without explaining the whole point behind it, which it expects you to already know from these other games.
Right, right. Like, if you've played AD&D and had a situation where your DM never tells you that you're done searching the room, right? And I think those of us who've been around a long time, we've had those games or even those campaigns. Yeah. And it drives you wild, you know, until you then reach another DM that does it so differently and you go, oh, this is how to run a game. I agree that this is almost like just thinking that you understand this in the background. So, yeah.
It also tells us that the players are the audience to the game stories, not the characters. So you want to do things that will resonate with the players rather than just resonate with the characters. which is good advice. And I've seen game masters, and probably myself included, that forget that sometimes, get so bogged down in the rules and in the intricacies of a design that you forget that there are players sitting there waiting to be entertained and thrilled and listened to.
Yeah, and who like different things, right? We've talked about player types in the past, and it matters whether you are into exploration or role play or combat or what the mix is between those areas. Yeah.
I think of some players that want to be entertained by the game master as well.
Yeah.
So the book here gives a great example of rolling a random encounter in front of the players to give that sense of tension, to build up that sense of tension. And sometimes, especially if you're running in a timed environment, you may forget that, right?
Right.
You may forget that the experience is happening to the players, not just the characters. So you want to add some theatrics, maybe
Yeah.
add some things that will please worry in a good way the audience at the table, which are your players.
Totally.
So we got through the role of the GM and player section. Now we get to the core ethos, which is multiple and manifold. It's time, darkness, gear, action economy, information, distance, danger, rewarding investment, stat checks.
And I mean,
Whew.
imagine that you were to tell me, hey, I'm writing a role-playing game. I'm gonna give the core elements of the game about a sentence or two each. But that's what
20,
this,
20 words or less.
mean, it's amazing. Like there's just one page with your core aspects, right? And it because it's just sort of loose guidelines around, respect the darkness. It is the true foe. Time is the most important resource. It must haunt the character's every decision. You don't have time to check everything. Like, gear is precious and limited. One action per turn. Precise measurements aren't needed. The game is dangerous. Reward investment. It's really kind of amazing how the game does this. It's really incredible.
And again, it goes back to this game is for people who have played other games and understand what all of these things mean
Yeah.
without needing 10 pages to describe each.
And that's not to say that you can't be new and work off of this perfectly, but
Oh, yeah.
it rests on that foundation and assumes it. The section on balance is also really interesting, where it's kind of like be unpredictable. But it doesn't exactly tell you, how to do that, just be unpredictable. The numbers are sort of a starting point and then work off of that and telegraph danger. And make choices matter. Okay.
Well, I mean, I will not running. I will be playing this game at GaryCon in 2 weeks.
Cool.
So I will have more to say, even if it's briefly, after I play. But it's easy to be unpredictable when the game itself has little care for the lives of the characters. I would love to be completely wild and wacky and unpredictable in the stories that I tell in all games, but some games need more balance than others.
For sure, for sure.
And so this game can lean into being imbalanced and unpredictable. I don't know if you need to telegraph the danger. It sounds like the danger is pretty well telegraphed.
It's all dangerous. They'll learn quickly. But I think the idea is that where they're trying to get here is that the gameplay is supposed to be on what do you do about this danger, not, oh, hey, this danger surprised you. Not that the dangers don't surprise you through random encounters and things like that. But and that's, I think, what's behind the like, if you think this square is trapped and you check it, you find the trap. Because it's not about the haha gotcha. It's about the did you pick up on the thing in the room description such that you check for the trap, right? It's the what do you do about it?
Well, it's the entertain the players, right? It's bring the players into the game by talking about the scratch marks on the floor
Right.
that will trigger the player, not the character, to say, okay, I checked the floor.
Yeah.
Because by checking the floor, you succeed, unless there's a time limit or something is imperiling you at the moment to right. call for your character to make the check. So that's what this telegraph danger means, because it brings the player into the game.
And something that's interesting is, so, you know, this section has so far been advice, heavily advice, right? It's not a rules section of how to run the game. And we get a running the game section. And I think to myself, oh, okay, this is gonna be full of it. But it kind of continues with advice, what an adventure is, what a campaign is, how to run NPCs, make the mundane matter, like, you know, your gear should always matter no matter what level you are. And then it gets into setting DCs. And suddenly we have a little bit of rules, right? The DCs are easy, 9, normal, hard, extreme. Each one goes up by 3. So between 9 and 18 for sort of your typical 4 DCs. And then it says, take the person making the check into account. So an elf has an easier time finding a trail than a sun-dazzled cave troll. So, you know, and what this is doing is, in other games, you might have skill ranks and so on, so that things, you know, this is what I'm good at. Here, the DM is told, instructed to compensate, right? The cave troll that's outside in the sunlight can't find the trail, and so the DC might be extreme, but the elf has sharp eyes and is good at this sort of stuff, so maybe it's easy. Your call, right? And that's really very interesting, I thought.
Yeah. And that sort of, again, flips back and forth between, if you look for something, you find it.
Yeah.
If you look in the right place, versus if you can't look in the right place, or you can't do it quickly, or, you know, if you can't take your time to do it, or if there's a danger around you at the time, then make the check. So we get sort of more advice that, here, these are the DCs, but only use them when it's not an automatic success. When's it an automatic success? I don't know, except maybe I do, but I'm the DM, so I can make the rules anyway. And I'm not saying that to be flippant. It's just, these are the things that run through a game master's head as they are leading a group of players through an adventure, regardless of the system. So you just have to take the system's advice into account as best you can.
And an interesting part is, it makes the point in this not the enemy section that you are a neutral arbiter, but says that because the idea is, in this game of Shadow Dark, the players are sort of in control of their difficulty, it says. So, you know, you decide whether to push your luck. You know, the conscience of this game is, you decide whether to keep going, right? Your light might run out. You might be fighting the darkness on the way back. You might run into random encounters because your luck turns and suddenly you're overwhelmed. You have decisions like, do I give up a couple of torches to open up some gear slots to carry treasure so I can leave with more XP? All of this is sort of creating toggles the players can choose. To which I say, yes, but, you know, certainly when I ran the gauntlet session recently, boy, we weren't making these kinds of choices. The adventure was just beating us up. And sometimes that's just the way it goes, especially with few characters in the party. It can be that the players aren't controlling that toggle. Like, this game is random enough in multiple ways. Right. That it's not as simple as the characters just choosing to push their luck or not. They could, I mean, and that's been true of a lot of classic games, right? I ran lots of AD&D sessions where it was great. We return to the Temple of Elemental Evil. You encounter wolves along the way. They slaughter you. You go back to town again. You know, like, players were being cautious. Yeah. Didn't matter. They encountered wolves, too many, and they got murderized, you know?
Yep. To say that it's the character's choice about how hard to make it requires a very balanced game, right? The MCDM game, if you've played a preview of it, right? Yeah. They have a specific mechanic in place called victories, where if you get a victory, it gives you more power going forward, but you also have fewer resources in terms of hit points, recoveries, and so on.
Yeah.
So that is a game that's carefully balanced to make that true of, we're going to push our luck because we have more power at our disposal, even though we have less health and those sorts of resources. It can be true in this, but if it's not pinpoint balanced, it becomes less true, as you've been saying, Teos.
So we get a few more sections here that are kind of, you know, advice for the game master. There's a Let There Be Darkness section that gives you ideas on how to threaten torches. You know, there is a light mishaps table of things that can happen, ideas that enemies could try to extinguish your torches, spellcasters could target it with spells such as dispel magic to end light, the environment like gusts of wind and things like that. And then we get this modes of play that came up in our question. These are really quick, brief ideas on what you can do, right? Things like the light only lasts 30 minutes, not an hour. Reroll initiative at the start of every combat mode. And these all have names, like Blitz mode is the light timers. Chaos is rerolling initiative every start. Fatality mode, you die at zero hit points. Hunter mode, defeated monsters grant half your XP, or grant XP equal to half their level round down. Pulp mode, which gives you lots of tokens. What do you think of this, Sean, especially kind of given our question?
Yeah, given the question, I think it tries to do a job that is very admirable, which is say, you can play this many different ways and you can tweak it and you have all these buttons and bells and whistles and you can do these things. But unless you've actually run the game, you don't know the starting point.
Sure. Yeah.
And without a game being very well balanced, this sort of tweaking of something could work very, very well, but you might never know why it worked.
Mm-hmm.
It could accidentally work well. It could have the opposite effect. You don't know. And again, if you're making the rules as the game master, then all of these are just sort of suggestions that you could do anyway, rather than being actual modes of play.
Yeah.
So it's good to know, it's good to be told you can do these things. I just don't know how they would work. Even if I'd run 30 games of Shadow Dark, I still might not understand how this would actually affect play.
I mean, looking at a couple of the published adventures, official ones even, to me, which adventure I choose will have more effect on the game than these modes of play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if I use a certain mode of play with one adventure, it'll be a sad time. and yes. On the other hand, it would make it great. Like, probably my favorite of these is pulp mode, because this idea of having lots of luck token capabilities, like starting every session with 1d4 luck tokens, right? That would help in some of the situations I've had with the harder adventures that have been difficult, and would probably just make gameplay more pulpy and fun and you know, hijinks in the easier games that I've had. Like, that's one that I could see that I think to me works a little better. But some of the others are a little tougher, and things like hunter mode, if you're fighting level one monsters, half XP is zero, so you wouldn't really benefit from it, and so it's only the harder ones, but you might not be able to take, you know, it gets into that kind of question. We get a section on random encounters, and there are a couple of tables that are helpful, like starting distance, what is the creature doing. I like that a lot, right? Just as a general, like, hey, they're not just always just ready to murder you. But then we get a section on reaction checks, and sort of like with 5e's playtest rules, I wasn't super satisfied by this, partly because it has a weird disconnect to me, and 5e does this as well, of the timing of the reaction check. So, you know, I know how far away they are. I know what they're doing. Like, maybe they're building or nesting, right, as a result on the table. But now I'm told, roll to see what their attitude is, which could be hostile, suspicious, neutral, curious, or friendly. And then if the characters immediately interact with the creatures, they can add their charisma modifier to that check. So it's almost like you got to write this down on a piece of paper and then see if the players do anything and then alter it. I don't know that. I don't love that. I'd rather go back to what they're doing and play off of what they're doing.
Yeah. Because this is just a random check, I see this more as a prompt or as a suggestion rather than as a rule. It's like, okay, you find horrible trolls who are eating, but oh, I rolled double sixes on my check, so they're friendly. Okay, so now I'm going to kick in, why are they friendly? Oh, they're friendly because the last group that came through gave them food, and so they think they're going to get more food from you. So I can, you know, I can use that as a prompt. If this was being used to sort of create an adventure, not just a random encounter, I would like it less. But as it is, it's just sort of out there to give you something to start with.
Right, right.
Yeah. What else do we have here? We have the treasure. Oh, the treasure. There's a 50% chance that random creatures will not have treasure. So that is to stop you from getting too much XP from just random encounters because it wants you to attack the meat of the adventure to get your bonuses and your rewards.
We get a couple tables on traps and hazards. Most should have a hint or a tell. If you search the area, you find it. Thieves are trained in traps. If there is a pressure, you make a check. Otherwise, you disable it. So I think the idea is that if we're in combat and I know that there is a thing here, a lever, whatever, a trap mechanism that I could disable, then I probably have to make a check, which we see in the example of play. But if I'm outside of combat, then it's just disable it. And it's good to see that, but it sort of takes, it kind of is not fully addressed in several places, and you have to kind of read them all to understand that. But it is a nice table of sort of just neat ideas and the effects they can have and how a hazard might weaken you. Interesting concepts.
Yeah, I saw the trap chart table and I was like, okay, cool. And then I looked, I was like, okay, if you roll a one, it's a crossbow and it's a D6 damage. So, all right, you're taking 3 points of damage. Okay. And then if you roll a 12, it's a cursed statue that casts a spell on you and does 3d10 damage.
Yeah, and or like, petrifies you.
Well, yeah, I'll just take the three. You know, it's between 3 and 15 points of damage from a trap, depending on what you roll with that d12. That seems rough.
Yeah, and I mean that's where it's all levels of play, and it's not accounting for how many people are in the party and that kind of thing. And so I guess that's why you better have a tell that this statue looks weird because. You know, but and that's a thing that I think this game I wish addressed. I think like because to me, some of the great play comes when you can, as a DM, understand the system well enough to know how to play off of it. Right. So if this statue is super dangerous, but I give it a tell and now they know to check the thing to disable it and they're going to always succeed outside of combat, my gameplay will become very boring and repetitious. This thing is a really dangerous thing. You check it, you disable it, moving on, you know? So how do I make that interesting? And if you are a very experienced DM, well, then you will have a lot of ideas at your disposal because you've done a lot of things like this. But if you're new, you may not quite understand it. And you may just go, well, okay, I'm going to stop giving tells. And then you're murderizing some of your characters. And, you know, that's that kind of balance there.
We also get hazards, then another table with hazards that are passive dangers, it's called, in the environment that you're going to be adventuring in. These do things more like restrict movement rather than do large amounts of damage, but they're still interesting hazards. There's three columns, one for movement, one for damage, and one for weakening. It's interesting, but I don't know what they mean, especially weaken. Certain hazards weaken or hamper the characters. This could include anti-magic zones or vapors that sap physical strength. So if I roll, okay, I want to weaken them and I roll an 8, it's numbing cold. But as a GM, I don't quite know what that means. Was there a weakened state that I don't remember reading about, even though I read this?
Yeah. Yeah, there are monsters that drain abilities. So my guess is that that's what it's sort of talking about, but it's hard to say. And I guess the idea is, you know, you decide, you come up with it, but you know, do you know whether to do something that would be the right level of challenge for your party? I don't know.
The next section, we hear about the go ahead.
The next section is the gauntlet. And the idea here is that you use random generation to create four random zero level PCs. Each player does this. So you've got 4 0 level PCs, not first level. If you fall to 0 hit points, you're dead. If all four of yours die, roll D4 and make that many new characters. But you only play one at a time. And then you'll get one from the backup pool at some appropriate moment. And we're told to run this with brutal traps, lots of monsters, and many will likely cause casualties. So much for that tell or you know, easily avoided. It's about murderizing the players. The PC that survives becomes your PC. And so I had heard good things about this, and I asked Mike Shea what he recommended, and he recommended an adventure that's in the third of the zines that are officially published by Arcane Library. And I ran that Norse adventure, and we lost, I forget the exact numbers, but it was something like 30 characters. No, it was a little less, like 25 characters, but I only had 3 players. It didn't say anything about scaling. And the 3 players had tons of deaths. And at first it was funny and we were laughing. But it's things like, you know, like a zero level character, it's random gear. So you may not have a weapon. You may have, nobody has a torch, right? And they do give you a room early on that has some gear, but eventually that gear has been taken by the characters and things may happen. Like we had some characters drown with a lot of the gear. So all the gear had left the system. And you know, I even did things to try to help. Like I had I made up an NPC, because you're not really told exactly why you're coming here other than, you know, get the one magic loot thing. So I came up with a seer in the village that was sending them all here. And she would periodically give them glimpses of what the other characters had done so that they could, you know, find the gear and have a chance at surviving. Even then, we had so many deaths. I mean, every single room was just lethal. Even if they tried to sort of avoid it, things would go wrong. They died from swimming. They died from everything. And so eventually they went back there. I could tell they were a little frustrated. So I said, you go back to the seer, or, you're brought before the seer, you are level 1 characters. And she says, well, now that we got rid of all the troublemakers in the village, you know, you go be the heroes. They still had like another 4 character deaths before we got to the end. And it was way more brutal than I think the players wanted. There's a Reddit thread out there that has sort of a similar experience from one of our listeners. I don't know what to make of it, Sean. I mean, I think probably a big deal was that we had 3 characters.
Mm-hmm. And a terrible DM.
And maybe we could have overwhelmed the numbers, you know, foes. But I mean, just the foes did so much damage. And there are things like a random encounter that this thing attacks, you know, twice in a round, kills a PC with, I mean, everything killed a PC with a hit. They have like, you know, 1 to 4 hit points. They have con hit points, right? So it's just, it was... I don't know. You know, I wanted it to be really fun. And one of our players was very familiar with the DC funnel. And that's in that version of this game, you get to you bring all your characters and you get to therefore choose kind of which ones to hold back and try to keep alive and which ones to just use as fodder. They like that more, I think, than the gauntlet. So I think the gauntlet was a bit of a dud for my group. I don't know that obviously it can work. You know, Mike had a great time running it, but it did not quite work for us. Yep. I didn't win people over to the system, sadly.
That's funny. Oh, then the next section is awarding XP, and it tells you how to give your players and their characters experience points, which is what they use to then level up. So you get XP from treasure, which can be stuff of legend that doesn't have monetary value. There's 4 categories. Poor treasure, which gives you 0, such as a bag of silver or a used dagger. Normal, which gives you 1 XP, like a bag of gold, fine armor, or a magic scroll. And then fabulous and legendary. Fabulous would be a magic sword, a big diamond, mithril armor, whereas legendary is an artifact, a wish, a dragon's hoard, etc. You can get an extra experience point for clever thinking. And per treasure find, you are expected to find about 10 gold pieces times your level worth of treasure. We had a listener question that talked about this. And the question was, how do you give experience for gold? Well, we just sort of said it. You have to figure out what it equals. If it's, you know, if it's a half a bag of gold, is that enough to be one experience point? If it's a big bag of gold, might that be two or three experience points? You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing to understand is that gold is really sort of there as it can be a source of XP when it's significant enough. But it's primarily meant to be the fuel for your downtime activities. Mm-hmm. And so it isn't, you know, you don't need, I think, honestly, the characters are probably end with plenty of gold very quickly. But it's more about that dual fuel of their various activities. The XP side of things is really kind of what generally we're thinking about when we're designing for Shadow Dark. So we are thinking to ourselves, hey, there is some treasure here. Should it grant experience points? And if so, then maybe it's a bag of gold and, you know, or maybe it's something else, but probably most things can be sold. So you're looking at getting gold out of it sort of regardless, but it's really about that thing being a unit of XP, right? So you're thinking about the adventure and thinking to yourself, hey, you know, I'm going to have, you know, a few things here. And then there's this fabulous treasure here that drives the story, you know, like you must get this specific artifact. And then end the threat, right? And so that is the legendary or whatever, the really cool reward that's going to give you a lot of XP based on your gold. And there are links to XP and treasure from the monsters. So based on their level, as we'll talk about, there is a table there. And we're told it's not XP until converted. So really it means you've got to get back to town safely, right? Or at least leave the dangerous area. And then you would get the XP for it. You don't get XP, as I understand it, if you, you know, got the cracked emerald, but then you lose it or give it to someone else. You need to get it out of that dungeon to really have it count as XP unless you choose otherwise. But yeah. We also had Random Wizard on Mastodon that heard that dividing gold values by 10 can allow old modules to be converted to Shadow Dark pretty reasonably. If you're looking at the gold values in some of those adventures, though they tend to vary.
Yep. Awesome. Well, after the awarding XP section, we get tables. Lots of tables. Lots and lots of tables. 67 pages worth of tables with adventuring ideas and the Something Happens table and the Make a Shadow Dark Map table and the Shop Generator, et cetera, et cetera. Random encounters for all different sorts of geological locations and terrains and so on and so on and so on. All good stuff, all stuff that you could use to randomly build yourself an adventure, an encounter, a world, etc.
Yeah, I mean, even if you're working on another game, you might be like, hey, I'm gonna open up those Shadow Dark tables and get some inspiration.
True. Then we get to the monster section where a page explains to us what the stat block is. We learn all non-humanoids can see in the dark and humanoids can't. To create monsters that fly, a table of monster mutations, a page and a half on how to design monsters. How many monsters do we use? There's a table based on PC level. Per PC on what level monsters to use and how many. We get advice to vary what they face. So three PCs of level 0 to 3 could face a combined 3 levels worth, split up based on the number of monsters. The monsters all tend to be very simple. You know, the size of a small paragraph, a small stat block, if you will. You know, still... It reminds me of like first or AD&D first edition stat blocks with just a wee bit more content to it, because something might not have any special abilities. It just may be claw, plus three, you know, 1d6 damage. That's it. But it might be 1d6 damage plus charm. And then you'd look down and the charm would be a couple sentences of what the charm means. So all in all, pretty, it does its job as simply as it possibly can, I think. So that's good.
Yep.
It's good design there.
Yeah. Definitely when I was running it, it was easy to run the monsters, right? Every monster was simple, clear, did what it said it did on the box.
Yep. And last but not least, we get treasure. Treasure tables to determine random treasure. Treasure by character level ranges. If it's not guarded, that we're told that treasure should be character level. Typical treasure will occupy one gear slot. And remember, you have a limited number of gear slots. So part of the fun is, do we try to haul all of this treasure out with the understanding that I might have to drop something important to do so, like a torch or a weapon? And do we risk random encounters on the way out, knowing that we're carrying all this treasure? Should we, you know, that sort of thing. So it's fun in that sense of sort of treasure resource slot management.
Yeah, I'm curious because, you know, I've had a couple of characters in Shadow Dark that had very few available slots, and I don't feel like I was carrying a ton of gear. And so I'm curious, if you get a magic item or two that you want to keep, like that's really helping you out, right? Like say you get, you know, you've got your armor and you get a magical weapon and you get maybe like two cool other things. Now your number of gear slots is really limited. So, you know, does that mean your adventures are shorter? You know, or do the players, because I have trouble believing the characters are going to drop magic items. So, yeah, I'd be curious how that plays when people are playing campaigns. You know, let us know in the comments, you know, what you have been encountering when you're, say, level six and you have a couple of neat things you've found. What does that do to your gear slot capabilities?
Mm-hmm. With the understanding that you don't get XP if you don't get loot out of the dungeon and back to town.
Right. And so, you know, what do you do? Are you just trying to make lots of trips? And does that affect the play? And does your DM go no? Or I don't, you know, what do you do balance wise there? It's
interesting. Yep. And then we get, you know, the player's favorite part of any book, all the magic item descriptions and what they do. And so it's all there. And then at the end, we have a sample character sheet, and the inside cover has useful tables that are reprinted there for easy access. So we have made it through Shadow Dark. Overall, I think what my thoughts are, when I heard my game design friends, who I respect greatly, telling me how great this game was, I came in with an expectation that I should not have come in with. I should have come in with the understanding that this is a system to play a certain kind of game for players that already like a certain kind of game and will tweak things to fit their particular bent, not relying necessarily on the rules to make that experience for them. And in that, I think Kelsey did an absolutely amazing job of understanding the audience that she was catering this game toward, and very elegantly and gracefully pulling the needed material from not just D&D, but from other indie games into a system that could work together in a pleasing way for that audience that she was going for.
Yeah, that's great. That's on point. I had similar sort of thoughts reading the book when it arrived in the mail. I was really surprised that, hey, wow, the player side is super fifth edition, but distilled down. And how efficiently it was distilled. In a million years, I would never be able to distill fifth edition down to something this good. And it all works really well while honoring a lot of really neat OSR concepts and play styles. And so, like, I played Dragonbane this last Friday, and I had not played it before. So DM introduced us to it, and I played it. I haven't read it. And it was really interesting comparing that, because it is also a light game, and I've also played things like Morkborg or Vessen. There are a lot of games that are trying to be simple these days, and you can really hit the rub of what is that simple, what makes it simple, and how does it work over time. And Dragonbane has some pieces that seem to rub against each other. This game doesn't really have a lot of that. Like, it manages to avoid pitfalls, which is, it's hard to state how easy it is to do that, right? I mean, 5e has that problem. But all these games that are trying to be simpler usually run into some issues. They may still be super fun, but they can run into some issues. There are some here around lethality, but none of it's really around the construction, the vision for the game. It's really a choice about how this game is written to give you a lot of ideas with few words and have you play off of it and decide your style and your take off of it. And I think that it can be for a lot of people, and has been for a lot of people, a fantastic change away from a more dense game, whether it's 5e or something else, to be one that's as well written as this is and has that kind of structure and elegance to it. Yeah, it's a really neat thing. I'm ready for the second edition of it almost, because there have been things like the torch, right? The idea of like, oh, well, you randomize your torch timer. And I think the community is so active that the play for this book is through the roof. And so people have a lot of ideas, and the cursed scroll zines are adding to it and adding character classes and adding adventures and concepts and source books. And so there's a lot there that I could see that before too long, Kelsey might want to create a second edition, and the audience might be very receptive to that, to bring in all of these neat ideas. Most games that are out there don't get that kind of feedback, so there's nothing propels towards a second edition. This right. might really do it, because it has such an active community, which yeah. comes off of how successful Kelsey has been at growing an audience. Well deserved.
You can't make a second edition until I play the first edition. That's all. That's the only thing I ask.
Fair enough. Hey Kelsey, okay. Could you hold off?
Yeah. No. And in our show notes, we have that interview that Kelsey did discussing the design of Shadow Dark, the YouTube discussion. It's in our show notes. So, Teos, we're glad you're back. We're glad you're safe.
Wonderful
and sound physically, if not necessarily mentally, but it's good to see your face again. So thanks for sharing your insights, not just with Shadow Dark, but the news as well with us. And we'd like to thank our patrons out there and all our listeners. If you're a listener but not a patron, you can help us out by becoming a patron by going to patreon.com/masteringdnd and joining us as a Master of Dungeons supporter, as a Master of Realms supporter, who get a shout out in our show notes, or a Master of the Multiverse patron, who gets mentioned on the show right now as I mangle your name. Chris Webster, Xavier Wozniak, Graham Ward, James Walton, Joe Tyler, Trace, Krishna Simone, say yes, Andy Shockney, Ross Sandberg, Chance Russo at Drago Russo, Vladimir Prenner from Croatia, Robert Pasley, Post Fiction RPG Audio, Mighty Zeus, Mike Olson, Tom Nelson of the Deck of Player Safety fame, Falcon Neal, Sean Molly, The Micro Ant, Eric Mengi, The Mathemagician, Chad Lynch, Jim Klingler, aka DM Prime Mover, Brian King, Chad Jackson, Sean Hurst, sorry, I forgot the T. Ben Heisler and Paige Lightman, The Mighty Jerd, Nathan Fuller, Andy Edmonds at nerdronomicon.com, Seth Eckel, Darren Chandler, Evil John, Merrick Blackman, Steve Bissonette, Craig Bailey, Lou Anders of Lazy Wolf Studios, and Keith Ammon of The Monsters Know What They're Doing. Thank you so much for your support. You, listener, can become a patron by going to patreon.com/masteringdnd. You could also help us out by going to Apple Podcast or wherever you listen to this podcast and leave a review. Also, If you go to YouTube and look at YouTube/@MasteringDungeons, you can subscribe there. We're almost at 2,000 subscribers. So if you go there, just click that subscribe button. Help us out. Teos, where can people find you?
Ooh, find me at alphastream.org. My full intention in amongst everything else that I have to do this week is to do my lessons from Emerald City Comic Con blog, which I'm dying to because I found it totally fascinating. So I'm excited to share that.
But you can't wait to hear about that. You can find me on all the social medias at Sean Merwin. You can find the podcast stream, whatever we're doing here itself, at Mastering D&D on many social media platforms.
I have no idea what we're doing here.
Exactly. Or just go to YouTube and you can see us in all our glory talk about games. So we're done with Shadow Dark. You're back safely at home with a torch in hand. What are we going to do now?
I'm going to close out my story arc today on the carpet. Remember that carpet I mentioned? It's coming today.
I have
a carpet. It took us forever to choose. The culmination of the story arc plays out today. I'm pretty sure we're going to level up as a household. They're delivering a carpet. I rolled up the old one yesterday. My back feels it. So that was the reverse XP loss. I don't know. That's what I'm doing, Sean. How about you?
I am going to envy your carpet.
Sounds dirty.
It always is. The carpet, that is.